Well, it is nice to be here. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I have notes that I'm going to hopefully follow closely. And I start off by saying this to everybody who I talk to about KLIF and the website and all of that. I do not know everything there is to know about KLIF. I don't suggest I do. I do know a lot of things, and I've learned a lot of things, but mostly from people that I've talked to, not unlike yourselves, over the period of time since this has been up. I think I put it up originally in 1998. I was in between jobs. We had moved to Austin, and I was doing lots of surfing on the Internet, and I found all these great websites for the history of WABC, KHJ, WLS, and all this, and I was really surprised that nobody had done anything with KLIF or McLendon, for that matter, because, you know, it was just a gargantuan station, not only in this market and hugely, hugely popular, but it was very well thought of in the industry. McLendon always liked to call it the most imitated radio station in the nation, and indeed, in many respects, it was. And many of the things that happened at KLIF were stolen and taken to other markets and claimed for their own. So I started sitting around and just remembering stories from different places that I had heard them, some from Gordon McLendon himself, others from just disc jockeys that I got to know from Cliff when I was younger, working with Ron Chapman at KVIL. He used to talk about it all the time, of course. And I started thinking in my mind, you know, I actually do kind of know a lot about this. So I just sat down at the computer and started writing and writing and writing and writing. I pulled out a couple of old surveys that I had saved from when I was a kid and scanned some of the photos in and stuff like that. I put it all on maybe 20 or 30 sheets of paper, looked at it and thought, this is kind of interesting. I wonder if anybody else would be interested in this. At the same time, a friend of mine was starting websites, and he said, "Yeah, you ought to throw that thing up on the web." I thought, yeah, what the heck? So I spent a few hours doing that, and then you know, about the week or two into it, I thought, I wonder how many people have seen this, if anyone at all. And I put a counter on it, and after a couple of weeks, you know, four or five people had hit it. And I'm like, wow, somebody's actually reading this thing. So it got to be kind of interesting. Well, as time went on, the more people that read it sent stuff to me. Somebody would call or write. I started getting emails. I still get 8 to 10 emails a day from former listeners, fans of the radio station, former employees. And one of the neatest things is that I've gotten to know a lot of the former people that I grew up listening to and idolized. And even some of them I've become friends with, and we communicate quite often, in fact. So it's been a joy in that respect as well. And a learning experience. Like I said, I started out with just a few of the things that I remembered, and this is kind of a work in progress. I still update it as often as I can, and what happened is that people would send in a survey, and it'd have a picture. Oh, I never saw that. So I'd put that up on the survey. Or one of the disc jockeys would call or write to me and say, oh, I've got a whole bunch of pictures. You ought to take a look at them. They'd send them to me, and I'd put them on. And they'd tell me stories, and I'd put them on. So what started out just really for fun has now just taken on a whole life of its own, and it's continuing to be a work in process. It has, I don't even know how many, maybe 15 or 20,000 hits already, and I don't make a single penny off of it. It actually costs me to keep it up on the web. But it's been interesting experience just to do it. And from having done this, I've been interviewed by the newspaper several times. A couple of magazines have quoted me. Ben Fong Torres's book has used some things out of the website, and he interviewed me. Still promised me a copy of his book, but he never did send it. There was another Gavin publication that took pictures from my website and printed it in their Gavin anniversary publication a few years ago. So it's been kind of interesting. Even a screenwriter from Hollywood contacted me not too long ago and is doing some sort of movie about the year 1963 and the whole Kennedy thing and Cliff and the scene in Dallas at the time, and he was getting information to web that into his screenplay. So it actually could contribute to a movie, which just boggles my mind. But back to the history of Cliff. Where did it all begin? It began in 1947. Gordon McLendon and his dad, B.R. McLendon, were in the movie industry, the movie theater industry. Later, they actually would be in the movie business. But they started out in the movie theater business and were quite successful around the Southwest, had money. And Gordon bought a station in Palestine, Texas, KNET, and worked out there for a while running it and got bored because it was just too much small potatoes for him. Decided to move to Dallas and petition the FCC for a station. They gave him one on 1190 AM. Went on the air November the 9th, 1947. They had 1,000 watts. It was a daytimer only, local sunrise to local sunsets. They began broadcasting in the Cliff Towers Hotel, which still stands down there at 329 East Colorado in Oak Cliff. They were in the basement of the building, and because they were in Cliff, Oak Cliff, they decided to name the station Cliff, K-L-I-F, and that's where Cliff came from, is from being in Oak Cliff. They were in that building till 1950. The early days of K-L-I-F prior to the 50s was pretty much a leftover of the golden days of the old age of radio. You know, your soap opera affairs, lots of news, sports broadcasts, and big band type shows, things like this. It wasn't until around 1950 or so they started the Liberty Broadcasting Network, which started at Cliff, and it was a way for McClendon to broadcast his programs not only on his station, but on others as well. It actually started because one station, I think it was in Denison, Texas, maybe, called him one day and said, nobody's listening to our station because they're listening to your sports broadcasts on Saturday afternoons. What would it take for us to get a feed of your audio and we'll sell commercials on our end? And from that, it gave him the brainstorm to do a network. And it grew to be the second largest broadcast network in 1951. They had 458 affiliates for the Liberty Broadcasting Network, all coming out of KLIF. Part of the programming were Gordon McClendon's infamous recreations of ball games because he could not get rights to broadcast live from some of the stadiums of the games that he was trying to broadcast. Main reason, because the owners didn't want the games broadcast on radio because they felt like it would take away from the ticket counter and the sales of the tickets, the attendance. So they would ban him from the games and say, no, we don't want you to broadcast the games. We want the people coming to the stadium. Well, from doing this, he had the brainstorm to get wire service reports of the games and just call the games and recreate them in his Oak Cliff studios of the Liberty Broadcasting System. They'd have somebody standing over with an actual bat and a pencil and would strike the bat to make the sound of the swing and hit of the bat. They would have crowd noise on albums, you know, sound effects albums, that they would turn up when the crowd noise should ring down when the crowd should be quiet. So they recreated these things. The listeners really were none the wiser, just assumed it was the real thing. And in fact, it really was, albeit slightly delayed, because he was getting the information off of the ticker. He would relay it, you know, as soon as he would get it, but of course there would be, you know, many minutes that would pass sometimes. What was really funny is a lot of times the ticker would break, and so he would be standing there with nothing, and he'd be live on the air with his 458 affiliates. So he would improvise by telling the listening audience that there was a fight in the crowd. And he would sometimes go into describing this, you know, big brawl in the stands, and or maybe a dog got out on the field and stuff, and until his ticker came back up. And then he would, you know, say, okay, they resume play and go on with it. There was one instance where he was doing a game, and it went for like 20 minutes where the ticker was down. So they had this 20-minute fight in the stands that by the time the ticker came back up, he had half of the crowd in on the brawl, which, of course, never actually took place. So it's kind of funny in that respect. The only problem with Liberty Broadcasting Network was, despite the fact that KLIF was very successful financially, the Liberty Broadcasting Network was not. It was really, really stacked with debt, and it was never able to make serious money. In 1952, because of that, it went out of business, and Liberty Broadcasting went bankrupt. At the time, McClendon concentrated his efforts on his radio station, as he often would. When he'd have one success in one area, he might have a failure in another, but he would always move from one to the other. And, you know, as amazing as it is, as many successes as he had a lot of failures too. But you got to say this, he tried. He would try anything that he thought would work. Sometimes it did, and he'd be proclaimed a brilliant man, as he truly was. But sometimes they were terrible failures. The Liberty Broadcasting Network, from a financial standpoint, was a terrible failure. From a programming standpoint, it was brilliant. One of his ideas later on in his career was to put an all-ad radio station on in Los Angeles. And it was critically acclaimed at the time, but made no money. It was a great idea that just nobody bought, you know. So he had a lot of great ideas and bad ideas. But Karcich was another interesting thing. He had all, you know, I'm going to talk about some of these others, but Karcich, George, was one of these things where he and B.R. and Pierre Salinger, who was at one time the press secretary for President Kennedy, got together and were going to put these tapes together teaching people how to work on cars, you know, do mechanical repairs on your own car. And they would be on these tapes that you could listen to in your car if you had a commute, and it would teach you how to work on your car. And they sunk all kinds of money in this thing, but again, it did not become a successful thing. Anybody has any of those tapes, they might be valuable today. The billboard was on the side of the 2120 Commerce building. It is still there, only very, very vaguely. The time is certainly taking its toll on the sign. Cliff, in the 1950s, right after the Liberty Broadcasting Network went off, like I said, Gordon started putting all of his energy into the radio station. And there was a lot of things coming to head at the time. You know, there's a great debate on who started Top 40 Radio. And a lot of people think Gordon McClendon did. A lot of people think Todd Storrs did. And I think history is starting to prove that Todd Storrs probably was the man who recognized that there were about 40 songs on the jukebox being played over and over and over. And if you're a radio station, why not take those 40 songs and just play those all the time, and you would appeal to a wider audience and gain more listeners. And that was the basis, really, of the early Top 40 movement. Gordon, as much as anybody can tell, wasn't full-blown Top 40 till somewhere around late 53, early 54. Bill Stewart was one of the men in programming with Gordon McClendon at his radio station, Cliff. Bill Stewart's probably one of the lesser-known people, and certainly didn't get as much credit for the success of that radio station and the Top 40 format in general as he probably should have. A lot of people say Gordon McClendon, but Bill Stewart was the right-hand man, certainly the nuts and bolts man of the operation who would put the format together. Gordon would often walk in with great ideas that were just over-the-top blue-sky ideas, and it was Bill Stewart, a lot of times, who would say, okay, let's take that great idea and make it work. And how are we going to do this? Okay, if we do this, and we do this, and we do this, we can take the great idea and make it work, but also make it good radio. So Bill Stewart was the guy who put it all together, really, for the radio station. He is the guy that put the discipline into the Top 40 format of taking not only just the Top 40 records and playing them, but putting them in the right order, in the right sequence during the course of the hour, planning the news at the right point, at the top and the bottom of the hour, putting the commercials in the right place. And mind you, this was in the mid-50s that they were doing Top 40 and doing this kind of programming. Today, radio still does virtually this kind of programming. So the innovations that really occurred at KLIF, maybe they didn't begin Top 40 Radio, but certainly they were one of the key stations that perfected it. In the competition factor with Gordon, it's always interesting, and this is one of my favorite few sentences of quote that I like to refer to, and I'll read it here for you. Gordon once said in a speech to some broadcasters, "Time and again, without exception, successful broadcast operators have proved that in order to survive and prosper financially, any radio station must provide a programming service of utility to a meaningful segment of the potential listening audience. Neither sales nor general administration nor engineering comes first. Programming does. The station failing to provide some service of unique programming utility to one or another reasonably large demographic element of the population is doomed." Now, this is something he said many, many years ago, and it's interesting with what's going on in radio today, because there certainly is what appears to be, in many respects, with the consolidation, a de-emphasis in the programming, and certainly the business aspect of it getting much more of the emphasis and attention. But Gordon McClendon was always a programming mind, always. And like I said, he would always have big ideas, and he would generally refer to somebody else to make it work for him. A lot of the people in the early years that were successful at Cliff were some names that went on to just do some outstanding things. Not only Bill Stewart was very instrumental in the early years of success, but Don Keyes too, a man that still lives in Dallas. And I don't know if he was for a while on KAAM, working weekend afternoons. Is he still doing that, Bud? I don't know if he is or not, but he was not too long ago. I talked to him maybe a year ago, and it was just interesting to hear this legendary man who just is quietly hiding in Dallas, but a man who in the early days of KLIF was probably the most sought-after program director in the nation for people wanting to get a job. He's the man that hired Ron Chapman originally in Dallas Anyway, some of the other names, Kenny Sargent, Bruce Hayes, Larry Monroe, Jim Randolph in the early days, Chuck Bloor, Elliot Fields. A lot of these people were in the 50s with Cliff when they finally went top 40. Went on to bigger and better things, some out in Los Angeles with Chuck Bloor's Color Radio. Many, many people that worked at KLIF through all of the years have moved on to bigger and better things. Many of them are actually still in broadcasting today, and most of them will tell you that you know, their time at KLIF may have not been the start of their career, but certainly the education that provided them the possibility to go on to other things. Gary Owens worked at Cliff, KILT and KTSA, three McClendon stations, long before he was on Laugh-In. Tom Snyder, before the talk shows, was on Milwaukee's WRIT. Rod Roddy, in the later years, Price is Right guy, was on KLIF as a morning show man and as later a talk show host. One of the key ingredients of McClendon's radio stations across the United States, and he had stations all over, but especially here at KLIF, he looked at what the programming of a radio station involved, and he said, you know what, 90% of what we do is the same thing that the competition does. We play music. They can play the exact same records. They could listen to us and get the exact rotations and the order of the songs and play them and be the exact same. We all play commercials, often the same exact ones. We all do news, often reporting the same exact stories. What makes the difference is that 10% that goes in between, not only the news, the commercials, and the songs. The 10% is what makes the difference. If we can take that 10% and put all of our effort into that, we can be the one thing that stands out different from the rest. They can play the same songs, play the commercials the same, they can play the same news, but they cannot do the same thing for that small 10%. So that was where he began to put his emphasis. The first thing that he decided he wanted to do was promote and promote and promote. Promotion was probably the biggest and most influential part of the programming aspect that Gordon McClendon contributed to his radio stations. Unlike many owner-operators, he was not a man to sit in the ivory towers and just look at the bottom line. This was a man who took a yellow pad with him almost everywhere he went and was always, always making notes, making notes. And again, he would get the big idea. He wouldn't know how to make it work, but he would get the big idea. And often, his big ideas were just so innovative and so incredible, people would stand back and just admire, you know, the brilliantness of what he came up with. One of his first truly big promotions was also one of the most controversial of the entire McClendon Corporation years, and that was the Great Treasure Hunt. In December of 1956, Gordon had the idea that he was going to take a Coke bottle and put a check signed by him for $50,000 in cash. Not a small sum of money even today. In 1956, an enormous amount of money. They insured the contest for $1,200 with Lloyd's of London, saying that because we will bury this Coke bottle in a place that will be so difficult to find, it will be virtually impossible to find this thing. We will give clues that are so vague, you couldn't possibly find this thing. Lloyd's of London bit and insured the thing, which meant that they would pay something like 90% of the $50,000 if it were found. So Gordon didn't even have to pay for it because he insured the thing. Now, he told them he doesn't even want to know where it is. He doesn't want anybody within his company handling the burial of the Coke bottle, if you will. So Lloyd's of London sent a representative to Dallas, got the Coke bottle, got the check signed by McClendon. They told him at the time that they felt like it would probably be 10 or 20 years before it would be found because they would hide it in a place where no one would go for at least that period of time. They expected that 20 years from now, when somebody's digging up a subdivision or putting a phone line in or something like that, they would come across this thing and have to pay off long after KLIF would be gone. Well, KLIF wasn't gone quite in the 20 years, but almost. Now, what's interesting, the clues on the air when the contest began were things like, this Coke bottle is located in the city of Dallas. This Coke bottle is north of LBJ, or LBJ wasn't there at the time, but, you know, just incredibly vague clues. Nothing that would pinpoint anything. Well, what interestingly happened is someone stumbled upon it. Someone stumbled upon it and found it. Calls the radio station and say, I've got it. And they're like, very in doubt about this because they're feeling like there's no way anyone would have found this. Well, if you've got it, bring it to the radio station. Hour later, the person shows up with it. So, of course, they give them the $50,000, call Lloyd's of London and say, send us our money, and, you know, do the huge promotional thing about it. Now, what's interesting is for everybody else who did not find it, during the weeks that the contests were running, there were people that were literally digging up front yards on public property, too, trying to find the Coke bottle with the $50,000 in cash, well, not in cash, but in check in it.
That was in Kansas City when that happened, wasn't it?
This particular one happened in Dallas. It may have happened elsewhere as well. Very likely. But many public places were defaced looking for this $50,000, and it caused a huge, huge uproar among the city leaders. And in fact, this contest, along with several others that McClendon pioneered, resulted in 1966 FCC rulings that exist today about conducting contests that might deface public property or private property. There now are rules that exist on broadcast outlets to where you can no longer do these kinds of things because of that very reason. All of those FCC rules and regulations all pointed back to the McClendon contest bearing the $50,000. One of his other early promotions, which was real interesting, was the Oops Sorry, where one time they were doing a mobile news unit report and they were interviewing an excited man who had just witnessed a crime of some sort, and he used a few off-color remarks, not realizing that he had, and of course not realizing they were live on the air. This occurred at 8 o'clock in the evening, and McClendon heard about it and immediately had someone record an announcement saying, if you were listening at that time, we apologize for this unfortunate airing of some language that is not normally what we would care to broadcast over our radio station. If you were offended, we sincerely apologize. Well, what ended up happening was people started talking about, well, what did they say? Did you hear it? Did you hear it? You know, and some people would hear it, and then the embellishment occurred, you know, because it might have been damn, and by the end of the whole thing, it was something really, really bad. And so the whole town was talking about, what did they say on Cliff? What did they say on Cliff the other night? And so he got just a huge amount of talk about that. People were calling. The newspaper was writing about it. So then he decided to take out a full-page ad in the newspaper. KLIF would like to apologize for the unfortunate incident the other night, furthering it even more. And, you know, the whole whole thing just was really, it began just as a very simple thing, but then became a huge promotion. Years later, he would do the same thing on other radio stations that he owned in other markets, the Oops Sorry promotion, when no real oops even occurred, you know. Even in the late 70s, they did it on KNUS. I remember hearing that one. Television commercials apologize for it as well. You're right. Technically, KLIF, as I mentioned, when they signed on in 1947, 1,000-watt daytimer, covered the city of Dallas, had no nighttime signal. That changed in 1959. They got the authority to go 50,000 watts daytime and a nighttime signal of 1,000 watts. The 50,000 watts gave them coverage all across the north central Texas area, southern Oklahoma. The signal went from just south of Oklahoma City to past Waco, north and south, and, past Wichita Falls and past Paris, Texas. Huge, huge daytime signal. So now they were able to charge even larger rates to agencies because they were getting out in a regional area versus just the city of Dallas. Cliff was a station that pioneered jingles. Everybody still hears jingles on the radio? Cliff was the station that pioneered those. Bill Meeks was the production music director, rather, at KLIF in the 50s. He got some jingle, some people to sing, some jingles for the radio station, and they put them on the air. And this was actually originally intended just to fill the gap in between program elements while they shifted from one band to the next and things like this. So it was just kind of something to put in the lull so the announcer on duty wouldn't have to sit there and just, you know, talk on his feet in between the two elements. So Bill Meeks made some little KLIF jingles to go in between. They later became much more sophisticated, of course. Bill saw the light and all of that, left the radio station, started Pam's Jingles, and you know the rest of that history. Tom Merriman took over as music director and later started TM, two of the biggest jingle companies in the country during the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, started right there, really, with some deep, serious roots at KLIF. Cliff TV, yes, there was going to be one, believe it or not, in Dallas, Texas. Channel 29 was authorized in 1959, the FCC gave him a construction permit for Channel 29, and it was going to be KLIF-TV for the Trinity Broadcasting Corporation, the parent company of KLIF at the time, which was the McClendon Corporation. For some reason, according to an item in the Dallas Morning News, which I read, they never built it. I don't know if it was just a lack of money or what the case was, but it was supposed to be a local Dallas station. They did not act on the construction permit, and several years later, the FCC canceled the Channel 29 TV permit. Interestingly, there still isn't a Channel 29 here. There's 27 and 21 and 33, but no one ever got it, 29. I don't know where that went, but it was going to be KLIF. 1959, they got the 50,000 watts. They got the 1,000 watts nighttime. Then, 1961... FM radio frequencies were available. He applied for and got 98.7, which is now KLOV, of course. Originally, the call letters were KROW, Crow. McClendon loved those name call letters, Cliff for Oak Cliff. Several of his others included Keel in Shreveport, KTSA in San Antonio for Texas San Antonio, KILT Houston, Cable, KELP, Kelp for El Paso, Coast, the name goes on and on and on. Whistle, lots of them. But he had envisioned crow being a good radio sound because roosters crow, radios make sound. Anyway, another one of those ideas that didn't really click. So for a period of time in the early 60s, when you'd listen to the station in Dallas, you'd hear KLIF and KROW. And the disc jockeys would refer to it that way. Finally, in 63, they decided to do away with that and made it KLIF-FM. In 1967, they changed the FM to KNUS. And this was mainly just because he had envisioned an all-news station, K-News, and eventually somewhere wanted to put an all-news station on and thought, I better get those call letters now before somebody else snaps them up. So he just parked the call letters, really, on 98.7 with no real need for them at the time, but plan to use them later. As those of you from the Dallas-Fort Worth area know, KNUS became a big station on its own in later years. But it started out, interestingly, as a jukebox in 1967. When they split the broadcast of KLIF and KNUS, it began, Michael O'Shea told me this story, it began as a jukebox. They had a cart machine wired to fire a station ID on the hour and bottom of the hour. And in between, a jukebox would just simply play records, and there was nothing else on the air. And it was only just to keep the frequency on so that they wouldn't lose the frequency. And that went on for a while before then they began their underground format with KNUS, and then that later, went to Top 40 and, as you know, now changed to KLOV and is still active in the market. A lot of the McClendon stations, he had a lot of stations over the years. Back then, you know, you had the seven rule, so he didn't have all these at the same time. But some of the McClendon stations included not only Cliff, Dallas, KNET, Palestine, before all that, Cape, LEP, Kelp, El Paso, KLBS, Houston, which later became KILT, WRIT, Milwaukee, KELP-TV in El Paso. He did have a couple of those. WGLS, Atlanta, then became WTAM, KTSA, San Antonio, with an interesting point in their life. Well, it was known as KAKI. And an interesting story about that call letter is McClendon tells a story that during the time that he owned it, the ratings just were not doing well at all. He was having some good success in Dallas and Houston, but San Antonio was just not working out for him. He could not figure out what was the problem. So he changed the KTSA call letters to KAKI, khaki, mainly because he felt like it would appeal to the military crowd. That because what is it, Air Force Lackland, is it Air Force Base, and lots of military people were in San Antonio, and he felt like khaki, you know, the clothing they wore would appeal to them, and khaki would be a good call letter, and so he put it on the air, and the ratings just went completely down even farther, and he could not understand it, and they were all scratching their heads in the meeting room, and a secretary walks in and says, well, Mr. McClendon, if you don't mind, I think I can tell you your problem. This was a Hispanic woman. And he's like, well, I've heard from all the experts here. What do you have to say? She says, do you know what that says in Spanish? And he says, no, I don't. He says, well, most of the Spanish people here think it sounds like caca, which in Spanish is not a very nice word. It means feces. And I'm glad we saved this to after dinner. And it became very clear why the largely Hispanic population in San Antonio did not take a liking to a radio station that was named. So they immediately petitioned the FCC and changed the call letters back to KTSA, as they are even today. Keel Shreveport, an AM and FM station there, WAKY, Louisville, KZAP FM in Houston, which later became KILT. You had KABL Cable in Oakland, WYSL AM and FM in Buffalo, WYNR in Chicago, later WNUS, and he finally got his news station there. Cable, KABL, Oakland, 4W Detroit, and the aforementioned KADS in Los Angeles, which later became Coast, and those call letters still exist out there today. KCND-TV was an interesting station that you had two of them at one time. Pembina, North Dakota. Now, why would anybody want a television station in Pembina, North Dakota? The answer is, it's right across from Winnipeg, Canada, a large city. So he could care less about Pembina, North Dakota. In 1966, they bought this TV station and programmed it for Winnipeg, Canada. Lots of radio stations, lots of influence across the country. And again, he didn't own all these at one time, like he would have today. Those were on the roster. Some of the technical things. In 1970, Cliff finally decided they were sick of their little small 1,000-watt nighttime signal. So they petitioned the FCC to upgrade to 5,000 watts at night, continuing with their 50,000-watt huge signal during the day. The 50,000-watt pattern at night was supposed to give them a much clearer signal in through the mid-cities in Fort Worth. At the time, it was felt like the mid-cities was the growth area in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And it was. And so he wanted to get a clear nighttime signal through those cities. He had full number one ratings in Dallas, but he wanted to market the entire Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex. The signal was weak at night in the west side of Fort Worth. So he had this engineer come up with an array where he would put 12 towers up in Rockwell, Texas. And the FCC bought into it, gave him the permit, and they built this. It cost him over $1 million in 1968 through 70 to put this thing up. A lot of money back then. They put it up. It's 12 towers, half mile long, two rows, 200 feet apart each. Remember, at the time, you had to take meter readings every 30 minutes. And they had to have a meter reader out there at the transmitter because they could not get the readings from the studio at the time. They had to have someone at the transmitter. It could not be done because one person couldn't walk all of the 12 towers to do it. So they bought him a Jeep and put a road in between. And a very, very interesting story. This guy would hop in the Jeep, go from tower to tower, take his readings. By the time he would get back to tower number one, the 30 minutes is up, he'd have to do it again. So the people on their shift, all they would do is meter readings the entire shift while the nighttime pattern was on the air. You'd have to just... You were constantly taking meter readings. And I'm confident that they never fudged any of those readings. And we've all been there. Now, interesting story about the Rockwall site. A pilot in an airplane taking instruction is flying out there one night and is trying to land at the Rockwall Airport and sees these runway lights, two strips of runway lights, and a road in the middle, and mistakes it for the landing spot. At the last second, the engineer is out there waving his arms, saying, you know, don't land here, don't, you know, as he's about to clip the towers. The guy pulls up and gets out of the way. After that, they had to put large X's on the little road, the paved road down the middle of the towers, so that future pilots wouldn't mistake it for an airport and crash the towers. True story. Back to the nighttime pattern. The nighttime pattern on 11i is still one of the more interesting ones. If I had a chalkboard or something, I'd draw it for you. But it basically covers most of Dallas, and then there's a large large fishtail that goes out to the west. And the interesting thing is, you can be in some parts of the Dallas-Fort Worth area and not hear the radio station, but you could be in Amarillo and hear it at night because it's sent such a small pattern. You run that sucker now, don't you? Oh, it's not? Right. That is one of the famous stories. It went down Commerce Street and didn't bump the curbs. Interestingly, the pattern did not cover a large part of the area that in the subsequent years was the growth population areas of the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and that is to the north, to the Plano area up in there, to the Denton area, and all that whole corridor to the north where, as you know, Plano exploded and everything in population in the subsequent years. Some of the population in through the Arlington area didn't do what they expected. So what was a great plan then turned out to be a pretty poor plan in the end. And the signal today still does not cover the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex as a whole like maybe it could have or even did before they changed it from 1,000 watts to 5,000 watts. One of the more unique things that Cliff did on the hour every hour was their solid tone at the top of the hour. Networks used to always do that, mainly as a point so stations could join, you know. They would have the tone fire right at the top of the hour, and if you were listening in queue, that's where you'd quickly pot it up, and here comes ABC or CBS News or whatever. Well, Cliff decided that would be a great thing because everybody always wants to check their watch, or it was just a neat-sounding thing. So they created this tone at the top of the hour, the Cliff Automatic Time Tone. It was built into the console to where you didn't have to turn it on or anything. No matter what was on the air, if you back-timed to it perfectly, great. If you didn't, if you're in the middle of a song, a sports broadcast, a commercial, newscast, whatever, this thing is going to go right over the top, and often did. Sometimes the disc jockeys would get a little creative when they miscued to the top of the hour and would reach inside the console and pull out the device that made the tone go off and then have it on a cart so that it would fire at the right time. One can only imagine how many times people go, well, I know I said it last hour, but that was the case. They also had lots of reverb on the air, technically a sound that was very popular back in those days, a large EMT. It was manufactured in Germany, had a bronze plate. It was 8 feet long, 4 feet high, and 12 inches deep. Had a speaker on one end and a microphone on the other, and that was what created their rich, deep echo and decay sound. During Christmas time, real reverb. At Christmas time, they had a tape that was a loop tape that included nice tinkling Christmas bells. And I don't know if anybody that's from the Dallas-Fort Worth area remembers this, but during Christmas season, when they would start playing Christmas music, whenever you'd key the microphone, very subliminally in the background, you would hear nice little Christmas bells while the disc jockey would talk. And it was just a little cute little touch. I never heard that on any other radio station. Did they? Did they? That's probably where he got the idea. Cliff was huge for its news as well. As much as it was a rock and roll radio station, it was a news station. And one of the more interesting things about its news policy was he programmed his radio station with regard to news as if it was an all-news radio station. He did not want to miss a story. There's a famous story where he gathered all six of his newsmen in and said, what had happened was K-Box, their main competitor, had beat him on a story. I don't recall what the story was, but just completely beat him on the whole story. He called them all in. They sat down. He said, gentlemen, this will be over with just one sentence. He said, it better not ever happen again, and turned around and walked out. 2 days later, he fired the entire news staff because they had missed another deal. He was infamous for doing that. He would never be the one to usually do it. He'd have Bill Stewart or somebody else or Don Keyes do it. But he had many times fired entire staffs, many times. Cliff News had a policy of get it first, get it fast, make it dramatic. And it was interesting because that's pretty much what TV does to news today. He said, a little showmanship never hurts. That was printed right in front of the newsman at the console when he did the broadcast. Right on the console, said, a little showmanship never hurts. And it was interesting because their news was really, at the time, different than what a lot of other people are doing. They, you know, a lot of the other ones were very staunch, this is the news broadcast. He wanted it to be exciting. How can you make news exciting? He noticed one time when he went into a newspaper press room that there was huge excitement in the press room. Said it was just amazing. You know, the hustle and bustle, people writing on typewriters, the teletypes over here clattering away, and telephones ringing, and just lots of action. And he said it was just so invigorating. You walk in there, and the sounds were just mesmerizing. He said, I want that sound on my Cliff News. So he goes back, and he says, let's take and put the teletype in the room where the man is going to speak during the news. So you'd hear ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch in the background, leading an element of immediacy to it. If a newsman was typing a story, he said, I want him to sit there and hear that typewriter. Let the phone ring. Let the bell ring. It just sounds like a press room. It would make for more excitement. It makes it sound like there's stuff going on in here. We've got a whole staff of people working. When, of course, it was usually just one man. So he started doing these kinds of things and started making news exciting. He did quick stories. Instead of real in-depth stuff, he wanted 20 stories in a 4.5-minute newscast. When everybody else caught on to his idea of doing 5-minute newscasts on the hour and a minute headlines on the half hour, he did 20-20 news, which a lot of stations did then. You know, you did your 5-minute newscast at 20 after, headlines at 22, when 20 till. When other stations did 20-20 news, he did 20-20 double power news. Two newsmen in there speaking at breakneck speed, stories back and forth, boom, 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 boom. Interesting stuff. It gave excitement to even news, you know, where every other radio station was saying, we're only playing news because the FCC requires it. He's saying, well, by gosh, if we're going to do news, let's make it exciting. Make it something someone will listen to, not tune out. Everybody else in radio was saying, it's a 5-minute tune out. Forget it. Well, let's make it something that it's not. Cliff mobile news units were created. The story goes that he walked into the newsroom after they had the idea of putting mobile two-way radios like police had in their cars in the station vehicles, so the newsman would not have to go out and cover a story and drive all the way back to the radio station or find a telephone and phone it in. They could report back to the newsroom directly from the scene of whatever the incident was. And they would call it in, the newsman would take all the information down, and then the newsman would go on the air and read it. Gordon is standing there one day, hears the two-way guy radio in the report and realizes the newsman copied something down wrong. He says, now, wait a minute. Why are we doing it this way? Why can't we just put the guy on the air from his car? So he gets his engineer and says, can you hook up the speaker from the two-way to where it'll go in the board and we can just put it live on the air? The guy goes, yeah, I think we can do that. So they put it on, and then mobile news reports are live from the vehicle as opposed to having to be relayed. Now, interestingly, they usually only had two mobile news unit reporters in cars. But, of course, on the air, they would call them mobile news unit number one and two? No. They would call it mobile news unit number four or six or nine or 12 or even number 20, because saying it that way made it sound like we've got 20 cars out here, when in fact they still only had two. But if they said, I'm in mobile news unit number six, it sounds like there's six of them out here going. And one day it might be six, the next day it might be eight. So the numbers were always rolling around, but it was just another, you know, genius idea to make it sound like they had more mobile news units than they actually did.
At this time, please go to tape number 2.